go on to enjoy the rest of your day. And I know we several people had to leave because they're heading back to LA and Hertz, where the traffic is particularly challenging. Do you? Well, good. You're brave. Okay. And it's hard to sit for this long, so we understand that. But the what we'd like to do, first of all, they just passed out a survey, so if you can take a minute to fill those out, that would be very helpful. We use this information really to help us plan other kinds of programs for support, and so we take this information very seriously, and it's helpful to the foundation to help us understand how best to help you. So why don't we just take a couple minutes to fill that out, and then we can open up discussion and questions. Are there resources to help you? And yes, there are. And in the building blocks of hope, I should have one of those binders handy here. There is actually a segment there in, I believe it's the seeking treatment, it's actually in the big binder, that gives to you a list of assistance programs. So regardless of where you are, if you, what my suggestion would be is to ask for one of the social workers in some, it's what? It is in book five. Okay, so sorry, I wrote this thing, I can't remember where it is. So in book five, apparently, under My MDS Plan, it will give you, there's insurance reimbursement resources for family and caregivers, specialty pharmacies, additional resources. So page 28, 29, 30, and 31. So there are a number of resources available. We use them all the time in our clinic to help people with the out-of-pocket expenses, or if you're on a limited income, you know, there's paperwork involved, and people have to assist you in completing some of those applications. But there are resources out there. Some of them, like the Health Wealth Foundation, is something that is replenished once a year. Once the money's gone for the year, it's gone, and then they'll start up in the new year. But you can ask about it. The first thing you do is to ask. And there are usually, in every clinic, people or a person who is the point person to help in that process. So definitely ask about it. So that's a very good question. Okay, what other questions? Anything that wasn't clear, that you don't understand, that we didn't answer, or didn't talk about? Other questions people have? Yes? Yes. Okay, so that's a very good question. So her question is over-the-counter medicine. So in general, over-the-counter medicines, herbal medicines, alternative therapies, anything that you're taking, the first thing you want to do is really talk to your healthcare provider about that. Non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, things like Advil, Aleve, which was her question specifically, are really the hardest on your kidneys. And as we get older, our kidneys don't work quite as well, and you can end up with some problems with your kidneys. So that's the most important thing about those drugs specifically. They aren't as hard on platelets as people think they are. They're not even close to aspirin, which if your platelets are low, we tell you no aspirin. So there are a million different scenarios of over-the-counter medicine. The best thing to do is just bring a list with you. And this is why the MDS plan is so important, because you can put all of that information in there, and you can basically online download individual pages if you have the ability to do that, or you can make copies of these blank pages so that it's expandable. And then you just take it with you to your visit. And it allows you to say, here's where I'm at. And I know people that are very organized, my patients, who can figure out what's going on way before I can find it in the chart, because they're keeping their records current, and that really helps us do the best thing for you as providers. So if you take sort of the time to make the list of medicine, including over-the-counter, any herbal medicines, there are some things that will tell you not to take because they might interfere with your therapy. Well, we don't know enough about them, and they can be toxic to the liver or the kidneys. So it's good to just tell everything. Whatever it is you're taking, no judgment. Just say, you know what, this doesn't go with that, or this might be harmful to the kidneys or liver. And the important part about that is that any of the therapy that we give needs to be processed through the liver and the kidneys. So it's important to us to keep all of your organs healthy, and you healthy, like I spoke earlier, and so that there's no, we're not excluding any treatment down the line. So in order for you to have a bone marrow transplant, for instance, your kidney function, your liver function, your heart function have to be good. you have to meet certain criteria. So over-the-counter drugs, herbal medicines, supplements of any kind can make a difference, and we need to talk about that. I just tell people, bring them in, I'll look them over, I'll tell you, you know, yes or no, basically, based on what we know.
One thing I know, I think you a little destructive about adopting yourself, especially about blood sugar treatment.
Yes.
Which I haven't seen in the book, maybe I missed it. But there is a shot which you can have. You can look, I don't know if it works for everybody, but I was getting a blood sugar treatment, and I don't have to do it. I get a shot in a couple of weeks, and it eliminates even blood sugar treatment.
So the shot that you get, and it is in the book, so there is, yeah. Mostly everything's in that book. I know because I put it there with the help of many people, I have to remember. But there is a segment on transfusions, but what you're describing, and he did talk about it, are the erythropoietins, what we call erythropoietin stimulating agents, or ESAs, and those are Procrit or Aranesp. And they are basically erythropoietin, that hormone that's in the kidney that you need to take an immature red blood cell to become a mature blood cell and carry oxygen. So without that hormone, you can't make red blood cells, or you can't mature the red blood cells. Most people with MDS have plenty of their own, but there are a group of patients. So if he showed the slide where if you had a level that was below 100, you would do the best. Medicare and the people that authorize these shots, you, in order to qualify for reimbursement for payment, your erythropoietin level has to be below 500 in order for you to qualify, and that's because we know if it's above 500, you got plenty of your own, and giving you more is not going to help you. It's not the answer. So there are a group of patients who actually do very well on Procrit or Aranesp over a long period of time. They tend to have low-risk MDS and have not required as much in the way of transfusions. So that's probably the case for you if it's working, and that's great.
I'm at a high risk, but it works for me. I understand it doesn't work for everybody.
No, so that's good. Time. Yes.
It just happened to
right.
Save me from, otherwise I'd be living down there.
Exactly, and that's not what we want. So that's good for you. That's absolutely true. Okay, what other questions, comments, Susan?
So if you go through stem cell transplant, there's a whole bunch of things that can happen, and there's opportunities to succeed, there's opportunities for it to not necessarily work. What happens once it doesn't work? Is there another opportunity to have a second stem cell transplant?
So the question is about stem cell transplantation, which to date is the only potential cure for this disease. It's important to understand that in MDS, you cannot have your own bone marrow. So in myeloma, in lymphomas, we use autologous, your own cells. We collect your own cells, we clean them up in the lab, and we give them back to you. In myeloid malignancies, MDS and acute myeloid leukemia, you can't have your own cells because of the way those things happen that Dr. Bahar explained this morning. So you need an allo transplant, allogeneic, which means somebody else's bone marrow. That bone marrow can come from a sibling. That's our first choice because there's going to be less of a potential for that bone marrow to fight with your body. Or it can come from an unrelated donor. We call that a MUD transplant, meshed unrelated donor. Depending on, and then there's a match game, right? So you have, there's 8 original matches, you can go as high as 10, and what this tells us is that these markers that say, I'm more like you than not, the more of those that match, the better that is, the less likely you are to have problems. So we talk about 10 of 10 match at the highest level. If you're a 10 of 10, then the good thing is that you're going to have a little bit of this what we call graft versus disease. So the bone marrow, when you get somebody else's bone marrow, it is the immune system. By some miracle, they infuse it, it's like a blood transfusion. Those cells find their way into the bone marrow, they set up shop, and they start making all the kinds of blood. So white blood cells, red blood cells, and platelets. Essentially, that becomes your new immune system. That immune system may say, you know what, I don't really like this body. This house is not for me. And you have this sort of constant struggle. And that's why people that have allogeneic stem cell transplants need to be on drugs to suppress the immune system so that marrow and your body get along, right? So that they call that graft versus host. And but there is a good part of it is in that same process keeps the disease from coming back. So I'm getting to your question. So the idea is that the closer the match, the more likely it is to take. So the cell set up shop successfully, you have a new marrow, and that's good. That process of back and forth can cause some illness, and in some people make them quite sick. We can get through it a lot of the times, but there is a lot of risk. And if you are considered for a transplant, they will have that conversation very frankly with you. Risk versus benefit. It's not a simple process. And people can feel pretty sick for a while. I personally have MDS patients who have had transplants who are, for all intents and purposes, cured. And as far as we know, the disease is gone because they got somebody else's blueprint. You know, your chromosomes are your blueprint. They're what tell your cells to become a this or become a that. In order to get rid of the bad blueprint, which is MDS, you need a new one. And the new one you get is somebody else's bone marrow. If you fail a bone marrow transplant, you can have a second transplant. And sometimes they will do that. They will also sometimes use infused white blood cells from the donor. So they'll save those and give those back. So it's a little boost to try to get it back under control. But the question after failing a bone marrow transplant, number one, is are you well enough to do it again? How long has it been? And number two, can you find another donor? Because that donor that you just had obviously wasn't the answer. So it becomes a little bit more complicated. Is it done? Yes. There are people who have more than one transplant. So that has happened. Those tend to be younger patients. I'll go here and then I'll come back to you. Yes.
It's true that very seldom anybody over 60 did have a donor.
So the question is anybody over 60, which is really quite young, I might say, can have a transplant. So it used to be that way. We used to say if you get your own bone marrow, the cutoff was 65 or 70. We now do auto transplants, getting your own marrow, and people that are in their mid to late 70s. Because it's a lot like just some of the chemotherapy we give for certain diseases, and people actually do very well. So that you don't have that graft versus host problem, it's your own cells. So people can do actually really well. But again, you can't have an auto transplant in MDS. So for an allo transplant, because of this whole graft versus host and the intensity that's needed to treat you ahead of the transplant, you need good kidney, liver, lung, and heart function. You can't have any chronic disease that's out of control. And this is where we get back to be healthy, take care of yourself. If you do have diabetes, hypertension, any of those things, you gotta get it tuned up. So we gotta take care of the whole you, not just this little bit that's MDS. Your whole you has to be well. Because that's gonna make you do the best you can with a transplant. Then you need a donor. So the best donor is a sibling. So how many people that you know are 75 have a healthy living sibling donor? Kind of hard to come by. Now I have a patient who, 72, was the oldest of 12 children. Lucky for him. And he's had one of his younger siblings that was actually a perfect match. And we did an allo transplant and he did well. Most people don't have one of 12 siblings, and they're the oldest. So sibling donors present the least risk in just the whole process of the transplant itself. And then you get to the unrelated donors, and then it all becomes about the match. So if you're 70 in great shape, and we have these people, we will consider it. But we will consider it dependent upon the level of match. So we aren't going to be doing like two antigen mismatches where two of those 10 or two of the 8, if people go by 8, aren't connected or aren't good aligned, because it substantially increases the risk. And as we get older, our organs, the ones I just discussed, don't repair themselves as well. And so older people are just prone to having, you know, function that's not quite as good as when we had when we were 50. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So there's a lot that goes into evaluating a transplant candidate and deciding whether they are appropriate for the process. It's very risky. I mean, it's a big deal. An allogeneic transplant is not an easy process. We get people through it and they do okay, but there is a risk of toxicity that's substantial for everybody. There is a risk of death by the procedure itself. And so when you go to a transplant evaluation, they will go through that with you in detail. For you, specifically, looking at all the things we just talked about, here's what we think your risk is, and here's what we think the potential benefit is, and then they will say, is this what you want to do? So it's a very open, in-depth discussion. I'm going to go here, and then I'll go back over here. You raise your hand.
Yeah, if you have a sibling, and it would be like an 8 out of 10 match,
yeah.
And then you have a non-related donor that's 10 out of 10, which would they...
So that's a very good question. So the question is, if you had a sibling who's an 8 out of 10 and you had a matched unrelated donor that's a 10 out of 10, what would you do? Very good question. So then it becomes, are they young male? Let's say they're a young male. I will say to people, you know what, we need like a young male football player. But then, you know, I look at the deflate gate, whatever's going on. I think, you know, those people aren't so smart sometimes. So let's choose a golfer. Well, they're, you know, somebody. Anyway, a young male is probably the best match you can get because they've never had a child. And so once you've had a child, so your other choice is a female who's had children, they've had exposure to other chromosomes, right, in the baby because there's that exchange that goes on. So if you had two siblings, one brother, one sister, regardless of how you got along as children, we would choose the male sibling probably because they'd be least at risk. Then they look at how healthy is that donor, whether there are things going on, what's their family history. When we do donor evals, we go through all of that. And we say, you know what, I'm not sure this person's a good donor. So that would be the first question with the sibling. Then you would say, you know what, there is something to this graft versus leukemia effect, graft versus disease, that's important for long-term outcome. And in those cases, if that 10 of 10 match is a perfect match and they are a good donor, they may choose that donor, knowing that if you at some point do need a second transplant, you've got a sibling match down the road. So there's a lot of thought that goes into this. It's not that simple to say it's always this or that. It's about evaluating the donor and evaluating you. And it's very, very complicated, and it isn't the same for every person. Does that answer your question?
It does. If a female hasn't had children, aren't they?
Then they're pretty equivalent, yeah. But you know, those are the kinds of questions we ask in terms of deciding on a donor, yes.
Sibling versus a nephew, somebody else down the line.
Yeah.
That's one question. The other question is, how long does that go on?
What you mean, the graft versus host or graft versus?
So the when you have struggles to get through it.
So the first part of the question is, what about nephews, et cetera, down the line? The further you get away from your actual gene pool, which is your mom, your dad, and their offspring, the less likely you are to find a match. So we don't generally use donors like a parent to a child because, in a way, it's a different... They come from their parents, right? So by the time you get to you, it's not exactly the same. Cousins are a totally different gene pool, unless they have the same father, which we don't recommend. You hear stories, you know, but it's like not, right? Pretty much. So once you get away from your immediate family, it's really unrelated in that sense. I mean, they're related, but they're not first generation relatives. How long does the struggle go on? It's so incredibly individual, and so much of it has to do with how well is your disease under control before you go to transplant. So the question earlier, why wouldn't you go straight to transplant if you had a donor? Well, we know the people that do the best have their disease under some kind of control. It's not out of control, because the transplant preparation is just basically big doses of chemotherapy and some radiation in many cases. And if your disease is not under control, that gives more work to do, and then you put a marrow into that environment, it may not do as well. So you have to have well-controlled disease, and then the other one is how well are you otherwise? And this is the whole key about staying well. If you go into transplant not being well, you're not going to do as well as the person who's fit and otherwise healthy. And that doesn't mean you can't have diabetes or hypertension, it just means they're under control.
At what do you think? Is it 6 months? Is it a year? Is it 2 months?
There's no way to give a number because it's all individual. There are people who struggle for a long time, years, a couple of years. There are people, I would say everybody has some pretty intense, probably until, you know, we have this day 100 where we kind of do an evaluation for people, so basically 3 months. That's pretty intense, that period of time for an allotransplant. It can stay that way much longer, 6 months, 9 months, a year. It's highly variable, but it's an intense process for everybody in those early months, which is why we have the evaluation process that we do.
The question I had is, you have your match, your donor match?
Yeah.
If you don't do the transplant yet, how long will that stay before you have to get to the blood again?
So if you have a match, if you've been evaluated for a transplant and they initiate a donor search, which is worldwide, so National Marrow Donor Program is worldwide, they basically look everywhere. And so we have many people that find their match in Europe or South America or wherever it is, depending on your ethnic background. And once they've identified a match, that donor is, you know, they sign a thing that says, you know, I'm going to be available, but it's not forever. We've had instances where the donor gets pregnant, and they say, you know what, I won't be available now for 12 months, because I'm going to have this baby, and I'm going to need to recover, right? So the donor isn't there forever, because they're volunteers, and so they don't normally do that search unless they really think they're going to move forward to transplant. But they can; those donors can be released. After a certain period of time, they release the donor.
But I thought they take from their bone marrow.
That's an auto. So if you're having an auto transplant where you have your own marrow, you can collect it and store it for later.
Not the other one.
No, because these are volunteer donors. And they're not banking cells and just waiting on a shelf somewhere. They have to actually donate their cells in a very short period of time prior to the transplant.
Well, let's say you need it. Okay, let's say you have a match, and then about 2 years later, let's say you have a hemoglobin, and now suddenly you need it.
That donor's going to be long gone.
Might be gone?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
So you need to go through the blood work again?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because those people aren't just going to sit there and wait for you. So this is why the transplant process is so formal and complicated, because we have people giving their body parts, their marrow, as a volunteer, and that has to be recognized and appreciated, and so they're not in limbo. So they normally do not even test you unless the thought is you're going to go forward to transplant.
And at the end of 13, I did mine, but I thought I'd have to have it at the beginning of 14.
Well, you can be touched.
Now, my bone might not be there anymore.
Yeah, that's
if
true.
I have to it.
Yeah. Well, you can be tested for yourself. You can be typed. But if you are initiating a donor search,
they know if my donor's still out there, right? If I needed this now in the next 2 months to get transplanted,
well, they can check. The donor can change their mind. There's nothing in here that says they can't say no, thank you. Before they take you to transplant, that's why they do it like a week or 12 days or whatever it is before you're due, is they say to that donor, we're going to move forward, and if you've committed to doing this and you back out at the last minute, this person might die. So they make the donor say very seriously, yes, I'm going to go through with this. Because you don't want to end up treating someone and then not having a marrow to rescue them. So it's a very formal process. Yes?
This is off the bat, topic of
sure.
The topic. You have mentioned that in going through the stem cell transplant, course, you get the dose of the chemo, and sometimes radiation.
Yeah.
What qualifies for radiation treatment?
So we used to do total body irradiation in big doses, and that's to get rid of all the lymph nodes and the other part of your immune system that would potentially reject the new marrow. So you're basically eradicating or clearing out your own immune system to make room for the new one. And so now they do more of an abbreviated version of that, because we used to make people just incredibly sick with the TBI, which is what it's called. So they still do some form of it, but it's much lighter, and a lot of it depends on the donor's source. So sibling versus mud, and in terms of amount, and it's usually done all in one day. The TBI, it's like a single big, you know, a dose that they do in one day. Where there used to be other ways to do it, and the level of radiation that we would give was much more intense. So it may differ for each individual person based on the goals and the donor source and your age and many things. If you're very young, they're going to go full court press. And that's generally, you know, the plan. And but even then, we don't give what we used to give. We've gotten smarter about it, and the technology allows us to do better. Yeah. Yes?
How do they have it?
So, very good question. So, they harvest the marrow. There's two ways. We can do peripheral blood stem cells. So, the stem cells are those little cells. If you remember Dr. Bahar's slide, that little cell up in the left-hand corner, those are called CD34 cells. And they basically have the ability to self-renew and replicate and make the whole complement of blood. So, that's what we need. You can get them in the peripheral blood. You put a catheter, like a Hickman catheter. It's like a tube in your chest. We give you growth factor, so the things we use to make white blood cells increase. And they give you a lot, so it pushes the numbers really high. And then you little machine collects the cells, and they take, it's a pretty phenomenal thing. It's like the white cells go this way, and everything else goes back to you. So that's one way, peripheral blood. The second way is through bone marrows, and they basically take you to the OR. I mean, you all have bone marrows, right? I've done about 12,000 of them in my career. I have a little callus right here, but I'm pretty good at it. So, but you go to the OR because they take as much as they can, and sometimes it's as much as 500 cc's. So when we do a normal marrow, not always. They can't always collect that amount. So there are multiple punctures and multiple aspirates. So they knock you out for it, basically. So there are bone marrow stem. There's bone marrow cells, and then there's peripheral stem cells. You know, there's a lot of discrepancy. For a long time, we got away from bone marrow and went to peripheral stem cell. And there was some. There's still discussion about long-term outcomes, and it varies by disease. There's still some people that believe, you know, peripheral stem cells are different in that they've matured somewhat, and they have the ability to move out, and so the difference becomes in how much of this graft versus disease effect are we going to have. Now, these are donors, these are not you, because you've got a donor, right? But to take a donor to the OR and put them under anesthesia is more risky than doing a peripheral stem cell. So it's balancing risk and benefit and what you believe the long-term outcome will be. And part of that comes from how close the match is. So it's all part of that whole decision process. So it depends, is the answer. There's not one answer, unfortunately.
How come the left anesthesia would not be equivalent to a stem cell?
Because they're fully matured cells, so they're completely programmed. They're only going to be a red cell. That's all they get to do. When you get a transfusion, they're temporary. So they don't have any renewal capability at that point. Stem cells can make new cells. Red blood cells, once mature, that's all they get to be when they grow up. And they have a short lifespan, 120 days, and then they're gone. When they're transfused, like if I give a unit of blood and you get that unit of blood, those red cells aren't going to last 120 days because they're borrowed. They've already had some time, right? So they have a shelf life, if you will. So it's temporary. The stem cells are a factory. They make new cells. Totally different. Yeah. Yes?
What kind of side effects are associated with MDS chemotherapy?
Side effects with MDS chemotherapy. So we don't use chemotherapy per se in the true sense of the word so much anymore. There are some drugs. We use some low-dose cytarabine or ARC sometimes. In transplant, there's a big dose of chemo that goes before the transplant to clean the marrow up completely, and the regimens vary by institution, sometimes by age. But the chemo, so azacitidine and decitabine are technically hypomethylating agents. They target this CpG island, which is an element on the DNA strand and the protein that's there. So they're technically not really chemotherapy, but close. Revlimid is an immunomodulatory agent, so it works in a completely different way on the bone marrow, and so they're very different. The side effects vary by drug. So for the hypomethylating agents, for all of the drugs, anything we do in MDS, the most common side effect is myelosuppression, the Ravine, right? We need them to do that, because that's where the MDS is. In order to make it better, we got to get rid of the bad cells, and in that period of time, you're going to have the other ones, there's collateral damage. They're going to affect some of the normal cells that are going to drop. So myelosuppression, 100% across the board, most common side effect of any treatment for MDS, usually temporary, and hopefully your marrow will function better, and that will get better. The other things for the hypomethylating agents, so decitabine and azacitidine, Vidazol or Dacogen, you might know better, are the other terms for that. Nausea and vomiting, usually we can control that very well. Constipation, not fun. A lot of people complain. The things we use for nausea and vomiting, which mostly are ondansetron or long-acting, what we call 5-HT3 inhibitors, but the reality is it's probably the hypomethylating agents. So you got to. I ask my people all the time and talk about it, because then you're going to want to do something. You need a bowel regimen. Stool softener at least, plus or minus a laxative. I'm a firm believer in good old mom. Milk of magnesia, it's cheap, works great. You can take it every day, no worries. But you don't want to be constipated, particularly if your platelets are low because you can bleed. So that's a big thing. Azacitidine can be given as an injection, and sometimes people get injection reactions. There's a way around that, something called the air sandwich, which is in your binder. You might share that with your staff. Those are the biggest things for those drugs. Revlimid, myelosuppression also, very little nausea and vomiting. People can get a rash. That rash is not a true allergic reaction. It is because it's an immunomodulatory agent, which means it modulates the immune system. And you have immune cells in your skin, and because of that, they're sort of stimulated, and people can have rashes that come and go. So we usually treat through that, unless it's very severe. It can cause some low thyroid over time, so we check that. And what else? A little bit of probably irritation of the gut, so probably diarrhea, if anything. And those are the most common, yes. And those are all highlighted in Seeking Treatment, which I think is, look, I should know this. I think it's book two. No. It's really considered immune therapy or targeted therapy. It's an immunomodulating agent, so it works very different than standard chemotherapy. Okay, what other questions? How about you guys down here at the end of the table? Yes?
With it, hold back. Could I try Procrit again?
So there are people who, after their disease has been treated in other ways, can be resensitized to Procrit. And this is true particularly of people that have been on Revlimid over a period of time. There were actually some trials done to look at people then going back to the erythropoietin agents, the ESAs, like Procrit or Aranesp, and being sensitive to them again. So it's a possibility. In order to get the drug, though, you have to meet all the criteria, which is a low EPO level. You have to have iron, B12, folate, all completely corrected. You have to have less than 5% blasts, and only in that instance will Medicare and most other insurance companies actually pay for the drug. So yes, it's possible, but you would need to meet that criteria. Other questions? Yes, Susan.
So I think you did say 5 days is considered chemo.
Not really. It's kind of different, but you know, it's close.
So is one of the side effects chemo brain though?
So chemo brain is an interesting phenomenon. So there, you know, there are actually people that are truly recognizing this. There's a great guy, he's out of Harvard, Jorge Dietrich, and he's done a lot of research in terms of neurocognitive, just meaning how we remember or don't remember, changes on chemotherapy. And there is a real phenomenon. Most people don't completely understand what happens or how to fix it. If you talk to neurologists, so he's a neurologist at Harvard, if you talk to a neurologist, mostly they will say to you there's a certain amount of forgetfulness that comes just with age. There's a certain amount of forgetfulness that comes when you're just tired all the time. You know, when you're really, really tired, you can't think as well or concentrate as well for as long. There's a certain amount of that that probably is related to drug effect. And that part we don't understand as well. There is no fairy dust or magic wand to get rid of it quickly, right?
Sorry.
I know. So I tell people, if I had fairy dust, I would share it with you. But what they will tell you, and there's no quick pill to make that better either. There are things that people suggest or talk about that are used in Alzheimer's, but really don't have. It's a whole different process. Most people will tell you to work your brain. And so a lot of the neurologists are now recommending luminosity, that puzzle game online, which I have had patients tell me is really very frustrating. It just to have you use that part of your brain that is just memory and recognition, and so it's an area like fatigue where we really don't have all the understanding, honestly. But it's probably more than just one thing. Other questions people have, things you want to, I mean, we had conversation about the whole experience of having MDS. Yep. That's okay.
So with the Vidaza, even though it's not chemotherapy, it is typically done in a hospital environment. Is that for the safety of the patient, or is that for the safety of the medical personnel?
No, that's probably because the drug is very unstable. So once mixed, it's only good for 2 hours. In the original trials, they did it in a way where it could be self-administered. That's why the oral azacitidine, people are really hopeful that that will move forward. So when we give Vidaza in our clinic, we don't make the drug till the person's there, and we know they're good to go because you're going to waste it. It's only stable for 2 hours once mixed. So it's purely pharmacokinetics. It is not commercially available. It's in trials. The original trials, what they found was that people had a lot of side effects. So they sort of went back to the drawing board. Most of the work is being done out of MD Anderson, Dr. Garcia Manero, and his colleagues. And the trials are being run in different places. But they kind of went back and reformulated things, and it seems now to be better tolerated. So the trial going on right now is comparing that to the regular administration. Is it doing the same thing? So what we call a non-inferiority trial, where one thing is not inferior to the other. So the route of administration could be oral. And the idea is that to come every month for 7 days is a huge commitment, you know, because it's never quick.
You probably go back.
Yeah, we do it all as in our clinic as an outpatient, but that means you got to drive in every day from where you are, you got to check in, you got to wait, you got to, you know, our clinic is just like every other clinic, it is not that efficient. You know, there's always something that comes up, right? And then what should have taken an hour can take 3, and it takes a huge amount of your time, and we're aware of that. It's just that's the way the drug is available right now. So hopefully the oral compound will come to fruition and be approved and be an option for people. If you're on sub-Q or IV azacitidine, you know, they'll have to talk about switching over to an oral at that point. How does that look? If you have not benefited from sub-Q or IV, it's not likely the drug will work any better than the other routes. So that's an important thing to keep in mind. Yeah.
So why would a doctor, instead of a 7-day therapy, why would the doctor ever choose a 5 or even a 3-day?
Okay, so the original trial for azacitidine was done using 7 consecutive days. And so purists, like Lou Silverman, who did the original trial, a very good friend, and Aaron Demakos, my colleague, who's on the leadership board with me, will, you know, that's the way they saw the best response. There was then a trial done by Dr. Lyons that compared 5 versus 7, just trying to say, you know what, clinics aren't open on the weekend. What do we do about Sunday if you are open on Saturday? And he did this evaluation where they did 5, 2 days off and 2. They did 5, 2 days off and 5, so 10 doses, or they did the original 7. And what they found in that study, which was mostly low-risk patients, you have to understand, or lower risk, is that 5 was equal to 7. We know now is when you go back, if you dose reduce to 5, it's a 33% dose reduction off the top. Now, MD Anderson, who sees a lot of, probably more patients, them and Moffitt, probably the two largest programs in the country, has said there's people that can actually get away with 3 or 4 days. But those days are very small, so most of us will have you on 7 for as long as it takes to actually have a very good response. And usually that's 9 months or a year. And then we might be willing to go to 5, just because we're not trying to get you to spend all your time with us, right? And we feel pretty comfortable in keeping that response under control. So this is where you see people move to 5. We don't start anybody on 5 unless they really have bad counts, in my setting. Unless they have bad counts and we're not sure we can get them, we need to get them through it. There's a lot of variables there, but mostly we start with 7 because we need to get the disease under control. Yeah.
Is there, I heard their dosing change by days as it gets low cellularity?
Dosing change if you have low cellularity. So this gets to where the marrow, what are the reserves? So your normal cellularity should be 100 minus your age, right? So if I'm 60, my cellularity should be 40. Most patients with MDS are hypercellular, meaning that their cellularity is higher than it should be. But there are people who have hypocellular, so if the marrow is pretty empty, MDS. And what? So then we say, okay, what is the bone marrow capacity to recover? So if I know this marrow has to do all this work, make red blood cells, white blood cells, and platelets, and it's pretty empty, and I give chemo, and I'm going to put it in a ravine, and I'm already halfway down the way, what is my reserve? And so there are people who will modify doses based on marrow cellularity. What you have to really be sure is that it was a good sample. You know, marrows are not marrows. You've got to look at the actual sample. Was it a good marrow? Did it have the right cells to evaluate? Was the bone core good? So that you can really say with certainty, yes, it's hypocellular. And then you make a judgment. So we don't do that routinely off the bat because some people do well, and that hypocellularity is a reflection of the disease, and we still need to treat the disease. But we aren't going to just push forward forever knowing that it's down. Now, if you've been on therapy a long time and you become hypocellular, that's a different story. So start versus later, it makes a difference. Okay? Any other questions? Too much information. I know. There's a lot of possibilities.
So you said I as a, like in my husband's case, we're waiting for a transplant.
Right.
But he's multi-ethnic.
Yeah.
So it's a while for
hard to find a job.
Mm-hmm. How long has azacitidine been successful? In other words, is it like a 12 months and then it starts to kind of wane in its efficacy?
It's completely individual. Lou Silverman will tell you that the longest patient that he has treated, and he's probably used the drug more than anybody in the world, is even out 5 and 6 years. That's not the norm, just like the CHET is not the norm, but it can happen. If you look at the literature, the pure just estimate of the average, which nobody's average, so we have people that do better or worse, they will tell you 24 months. I have people that have exceeded that, a number of people that have exceeded that. I have people that are on cycle 39 and 40, you know, so they're beyond the 24, cycle 24, which would be 2 years, right? So it just is variable, and a lot of it has to do with the initial characteristics of the disease. How long has it been there? You know, as you heard earlier, sometimes it takes a long time to be diagnosed. And so that is, the timeline is ticking. So there's a lot of variables go into that. But we don't ever stop Fidaza once we start, unless it's become too toxic. Because the way the drug works in suppressing those methyl groups that we talked about, hypomethylation, when you take the drug away, that will all start right back up. And it can actually sometimes move in a more aggressive manner. So we treat until unacceptable toxicity or progression. So he should be on it until he goes to transplant, is what we would do. And I think that would be the standard care. Yeah. Other questions? Thoughts? Things to share? Susan in the back.
So
she's got lots of questions.
Well, some of them I already know the answer, and I'm asking for the sake of asking the questions so the group knows, but... So you just said something to me that went, is there ever a reason they would take somebody off by Fidaza, knowing they're going to put them back on, but maybe like 4 or 5 months later?
We would really hesitate to do that because we know the physiology. We negotiate. There are people that say, you know what, I just need a break. And then they'll say, I want 4 months, and we'll say, okay. It's like if you've ever seen The Picker show where they bargain the amount of money, right?
Oh.
My husband watches this, and they'll say, okay, I'll give you 700, and the guy said, no, how about 500? We negotiate, and we think about, so taking 6 weeks off is a whole lot different than taking 4 months off when you know the physiology of the disease, because in people who have failed Fidaza, truly failed, which unfortunately people stop without failing, we know that the disease then tends to behave badly. So knowing that, we try not to give them too much untreated time, but we negotiate. Because, if that's balancing toxicity, time, money, patient wishes. I mean, people get to decide what they want to do. We're not going to force you, obviously. We're not going to drive over and drag you out of your house and come get your shot. So we, it's a discussion that has to be had. Yeah.
Something I heard recently, we don't fail the transplant, we don't fail treatment. Treatment fails us.
Exactly. Very, very important. So when he said very, very important, you don't fail anything, the treatment fails you. So that's a very important thing. It's nothing that you did, it's just that our treatments are not perfect. And so the transplant can fail you, the treatment can fail you. It's a much better way to phrase it. You might have to be aware of that when I talk, because it's true. And sometimes they just don't work, and we are limited. And the good thing is having been at the ASH meeting, for years, I try to every year, and you hear people from all over the world talk, and there's some really smart people working very hard to figure things out. But it was a very hopeful and uplifting meeting in terms of MDS, because people are figuring it out. New targets, new pathways that we can exploit to treat the disease. So we should be hopeful in every way. Dr. Bahar is one of them. He seems like a really unopposing, nice guy. He's incredibly smart, and he has done some of the pioneering work in MDS that's going to move us to the next phase. And so there's this young group of guys, mostly some women, who are way, 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 way smart. And they're, just wow. Like, they must have other conversations when they're together that we would not understand. I wouldn't understand. And I understand a lot, but it's exciting. So again, the trick is stay well. try to keep things under control. I can't talk about wellness enough, so that those options become available for you, because they will be coming, and I really firmly believe that. It's been a long time coming. Yeah.
So you went to a symposium that was like international.
Yes.
Do they have a different protocol somewhere else in the world?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, for every disease, there is not consensus, and so depending on what's being studied, but I have to say in the MDS community, and I've been in this group, I call them my peeps, right, they're my peeps, you know, there it's a very close-knit group of researchers, nurses, statisticians. It's a family. I mean, wouldn't you agree, Audrey? This is a really close-knit group, because years ago, there were probably, maybe 15 experts, and now we have many, 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 many. And we have centers of excellence all over the world, and the idea is that you do build consensus and that you can have a consistent approach to treatment. It isn't too hard to do in MDS because we only have 3 drugs, and in Europe, they don't have all 3 in some places. In the rest of the world, they don't have access to all of these drugs necessarily, so they may see different things there. We're lucky in the United States. We're rather spoiled when you look at the world as a whole when it comes to medicine. But I think the idea is going forward is having this kind of consensus group, the MDS Centers of Excellence, the International Working Group in MDS, now the molecular subgroup of that, that there is consensus across the world and that you have all these brilliant people sharing ideas. And that's the goal. So we have our MDS International Symposia that will be held in Washington, D.C. And there's a patient forum connected to that, right, Audrey?
Yes, it'll be on Saturday, May 2nd.
Saturday, May 2nd in Washington, D.C. And so we'll have patients from that region, obviously, but possibly from other places. And that meeting is only MDS experts. The whole meeting is dedicated over 4 days just to MDS. So all the people from all over the world will come together to say, what are we doing, where are we going, what's next, and how do we get this done? So it's exciting. Those will be, a lot of it is posted. There are sections of it that will be available on the website. The posters are published in the Leukemia Magazine. I do believe they're accessible through the MDS Foundation website. So a lot of it might be more than you like. I know you're already going, whoa, man, my head is so full right now. So some of this gets to be way too complicated, but we always have in the newsletter sort of a summation of what does that mean to the real person. So you might look for the newsletter through the MDS Foundation as a way to sort of translate all that science into what does that mean to me. And then we will obviously update the building blocks of hope to reflect anything that is, a significant change in practice.
No. Yes, I could just add that Dr. Gore in the organizing meeting, that 13th International meeting, they already agreed to recap everything. So it will be our full newsletter that will have a synopsis of everything that was covered during our symposium.
We should challenge them to put that in, what is this, if I'm a patient, how could I say that in simple, understandable terms?
I'll encourage.
We should say that is his challenge. You tell him, I challenge him to that outcome.
I will.
I'll tell him. I'll send him.
I will.
No, because it's hard. You know, it's hard to get if the journal. I mean, it's hard for us to understand all this. Trust me. I mean, I read constantly, and it's hard for the general person. And if you're seeing, a practitioner that's in the community, and they see breast and lung and colon and prostate and everything else, I mean, the science is just so crazy good, crazy good. But to keep up with it all is really tricky. So we need these clip notes, cheat sheets for everybody, but at different levels. So we'll explore that. What's that? You can access it online through the MDS Foundation. It's free. You can get it. It's for you. There's a way you could check with Audrey on
yes,
how to do
and
that.
And in their Building Blocks of Hope, the newsletter is included in there. And I believe Sandy was our guest editor.
Uh-oh.
It did a wonderful story of transfusion dependence, and you have to read it, it's great. But yes, again, there will be information how you can join as a member. And we have your information now, so it'll all be in the database. You won't have to join. You'll be in our system now, so don't worry. Everyone that's here, we have your information.
Okay, you have a question? Yes.
Oh,
her name?
You may have mentioned it, I don't hear all that well. But is there anything that you heard about that's really promising about the clinical trial, other than maybe the medication that maybe our oncologist was aware of?
So the question was, are there any really promising things? So at ASH, the American Society of Hematology, the MDS Foundation hosts a symposium every year. And part of that symposium is to talk exactly about that thing. And it's been a long time since we've had that level of excitement. And to have people like Alan List, who's one of the founding fathers, if you will, of MDS, and Steve Neimer, and Mario Pozzola, who's out of Italy, and Pierre Pinot and others talk about the level of excitement in these new compounds was amazing. And so, yes, there's hope. It's probably, they're only available through clinical trials at this point. Those clinical trials are not available everywhere. But I would encourage you, if you're interested or have questions, to call the MDS Foundation. There is nothing wrong with you as a patient or a caregiver taking something to your doctor saying, hey, do you know about this? And I will sometimes say, you know what, can I have that? I'm going to make a copy because I don't always know everything. And so there's no reason for you not to say, would this be okay for me? There's no reason you can't go on to clinicaltrials.gov and look up MDS, and it'll spit out available trials for you on the computer. And or call the MDS Foundation and ask about it, because we always recommend clinical trials. That is the only way we get new drugs. It's the reason we have the three we have today, is because people were in trials that are required to get them approved by the FDA. So we always recommend a clinical trial. You can always do standard therapy anytime. But clinical trial, we try to never exclude a treatment option. So if you're here and I have two choices, and one's a trial and one's a standard therapy, I'm going to say, you know what, if you meet the criteria for the trial, let's do that first, because I can come back and do this whenever I want, however I want. But this trial might only be open right now for you, and so it should never be saved for the very end. We used to do that, and we don't anymore. We move them way up in the scheme of things. So it's good to find out what's out there and whether that's a good option for you and whether it's feasible for you to get where you need to go to get the trial. That's the tricky part, because they're not available everywhere. Yeah. Other questions, you guys? Yes.
Very personal question. Revlimid gets dispensed the 28 count.
Right.
And yet we take it every day.
Right.
So why is that?
Because Revlimid comes under a REMS program, which is basically a reconciliation and mitigation of risk program that is run by the FDA. Because it is an analog of thalidomide, which caused birth defects when the drug was given in the 60s, those same things have not been found in Revlimid, but we don't want to find them, so you can only get 28 days at a time.
It doesn't mean that you can't.
You can't get refills. They won't give you 30.
But you still need to take it every day.
Right. You need to take it every day, but they will not give you more than 28 days at a time. Because of that risk, you have to answer all those silly questions.
But so is it advantageous for us not to do the 3 or 4 days lap there?
What do you mean?
I mean, otherwise, they would have to give it the full dose.
No, you have to just order it a week ahead of time to be able to get it on time. We don't want you to skip
the
doses.
So it's a paper thing, not a...
It's a paper thing. It has nothing to do with science. It's purely mitigation of risk on behalf of the FDA. There's no science involved. No, it's just paper. You're right. It's a process. Yeah. All right, any other questions? I know it's a long day for everybody. If you have other questions, please call us, let us help. Really look into your book five as a tool for you to guide you with health and wellness and keeping track of your accounts and all of those things. We wish you all the best, and let us know if there's things we can do better. We take that to heart. And with that, I will let you get on with your day.